Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be speaking to Dr. Eva Maria Mushik about her book titled Building States, the United Nations Development and Decolonization from 1945 to 1965 from Columbia University Press in 2022. This is an absolutely fascinating book that looks at this really crucial period of UN history and really decolonial history. And Dr. Mushik argues that the UN played a key role in the proliferation and reinvention, really, of the concept of a nation state and its role in the post-war era through the processes that the UN was involved with around decolonization, state building, all sorts of things that I'm sure we're going to get into. So this is a really interesting book that I think adds a lot of nuance and complexity and different perspectives to history that a lot of us, I think, are quite interested in. So, Eva, I'm really happy to welcome you to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Miranda. Thank you for having me.
Could we start off, please, with you introducing yourself and explaining why you decided to write this book?
Sure. Thank you. So I'm a historian and I currently work at the University of Vienna, where I'm working at the Department of Development Studies. And I've long been interested in the history of development, which perhaps started with an exchange year abroad in Ecuador during high school, and an interest in global inequalities, and that kind of very naively led me to an interest in the topic of international development. And then at the University of Berlin, where I did my undergrad and master's degree also, I kind of discovered the more complicated history of international development, especially its entanglement with colonial history. So that was something that I was broadly interested in and wanted to write a dissertation about. And when I was about to start the dissertation at New York University, a lot of interesting work had just come out on the history of international organizations. I'm thinking of Susan Peterson's work and Mark Mazower, and how they explored the relationship between empire and international organizations, and basically argued that both the League of Nations and the UN were supposed to protect the interests of empire. But then, of course, intentions are one thing, and organizations develop a life of their own. So what I wanted to explore for the case of the UN was how the organization basically developed a life of its own, and how did they navigate this imperial legacy and mandate on the one hand, and this commitment to self-determination and state sovereignty on the other, which was inscribed in the UN Charter, the founding document. And I guess this is all a bit abstract, but there was also a very practical reason for me to write this particular book, which was that my first daughter had been born the year before I finished my qualifying exams at NYU. So the exams that basically enable you or allow you to proceed with a dissertation. And since my daughter was so small at the time, it didn't really seem feasible to go abroad for a year to do archival work as most of my peers did at the time. And since I was based in New York, I thought focusing on the UN would allow me to circumvent that problem and write something of a local history, if you will, on a global topic. So
that makes a lot of sense. I used the UN archives myself in my work, and unfortunately was not based in New York, so I did have to travel to the archives. But they were really cool archives, so having them right on your doorstep and sort of investigating them makes a lot of sense. So thank you for explaining kind of the multiple different things that led to the project, because I think that's more true for most of us. There's not just one reason that you end up with the research question. There's lots of things that go into it.
Go ahead. No, I just mean in different kind of settings, you don't talk too much, I suppose, about the personal considerations that are involved as well in those, in coming up with research questions or bigger research projects as well. So,
but it's important.
So
thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
I think that's a really important perspective, particularly I know that we'll have listeners that are perhaps thinking about their PhD topics or their next research project. So that's quite helpful. But I also obviously want to talk about the content of the book after all this investigation in the archives. So unfortunately, we're obviously not going to be able to go into all the detail of the book, which is, to be honest, quite sad, because even in the case studies alone, they're absolutely fascinating. So I do have to highlight that for listeners. But we'll hopefully do, like, you know, a bit of a highlights tour or something to kind of get the main points, I think. But I think that we need to start with some foundation. So the first one is, what does development mean? This is a really key term, and it's you demonstrate in the book that, like, this wasn't kind of a given what it meant, that there were kind of discussions around it, and that the role of particular UN officials during this early period of kind of figuring out what the UN was going to do and how it was going to do it. So can you tell us about kind of what does development mean to UN officials in this period? What does that have to do with decolonization?
Right. So, I mean, that's a good question. I think that was actually one of the starting points that I had as well, or one of the starting assumptions, that it wasn't as clear cut what development meant at the time, that there were perhaps more discussions going on. I mean, it's not clear now, right? So then as now, it meant different things to different people. But I thought before the UN Development Programme was established in 1965, before that time period, basically things were much more up for debate. So it would be an interesting period to focus on. And as I said, there was no consensus at the time. So, for example, you had people like Alva Myrdal, the Swedish sociologist who would later receive a Nobel Prize and who then worked at the UN Secretariat. And for her, development basically meant mitigating the problematic social effects that could accompany industrialization or economic exploitation, if you will. And others, on the other hand, understood development very much to mean to foster economic growth, to then be able to pay for social programs, education and health and so on. But so for all their differences, the UN staff that I cover in the book generally perceived development as a very complex process. So it wasn't a question of just focusing on say economic growth, but that you had to look at political, social, and educational progress as well. And they all believed at the time, and weren't so unique in this, I suppose, that this multifaceted process could also be sped up by government intervention. So it could be something that people, especially governments, could have an impact on and speed up.
Well, and one of the things that you talk about in the book is kind of the idea that these interventions, right, sort of were seen in a lot of different senses, because this is, of course, when, like, sovereignty is being debated and sort of who gets to do what was very much not set in stone. And you show that these officials were very much thinking about kind of idea of interventions and especially sort of technical assistance, and that this was something that they were pitching as being apolitical, that it wasn't an infringement on sovereignty necessarily. How did that debate go? Were people persuaded? Kind of how does this idea of technical assistance being apolitical fare in these early discussions?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it depends, which is the historian's favorite answer, right? But not all governments obviously agreed that technical assistance was an apolitical service. So, for example, the Soviet Union, until Stalin's death, denounced the UN technical assistance programs as a form of capitalist exploitation, as they put it, and even after 1953, they did participate in these programs, but never to the same degree of Western states. And with regard to specific initiatives that I talk in the book, again, there's this complaint that this is a form of interference in the business of sovereign states, and that this shouldn't happen. But this idea of technical assistance wasn't something that UN officials came up with. I mean, there existed programs like this already in the interwar period and during World War II as well. And it's also not something that Western officials had come up with, but within the UN, that such services existed, was actually the result of a campaign of poorer countries from the very first General Assembly session onwards, arguing that attention should be paid to the problem of underdevelopment, as it was then framed, and that international resources should be committed to overcome this problem, that countries like Brazil and so on that had invested some resources to reconstruction efforts, mostly focused on Europe as a result, or in after World War II, that they should now also benefit from international cooperation. And technical assistance was one thing that all countries could agree on, that would one form of assistance that was acceptable to countries at the time, because the thinking was, ideally, it's a form of advisory assistance, and the governments in charge can decide whether to accept or not, whether to accept or not to follow the advice being provided by these technical experts that were dispatched to countries who would have to request this kind of assistance also. So it wasn't something that would be imposed on countries without them asking for it, basically. So it's not necessarily something that was sold as apolitical by these Western officials and civil servants, and but something that emerged out of this campaign, basically, by poorer member states at the UN.
Could you tell us a little bit more about to what extent these services were new versus continuations of things that had existed before?
As I said, some services, the League of Nations had already pioneered different technical assistance missions in the interwar period. And then the ILO too, which was also born after World War One, had dispatched technical assistance missions both in the interwar period and during World War Two to especially also to industries that were considered vital for the war effort. So I think during World War Two there was an increase in these types of services. But what I think is different after World War II is that there's more of an effort to bring these different kinds of services that you have, for example, on labor regulation or on fishing industries, to bring them all together and to integrate them into a comprehensive, all-encompassing development plan, which is something that becomes more and more popular after World War II. So there's definitely a continuation. This wasn't the new thing that UN officials at the time also sometimes presented it to be, but there's a change in the extent of this being provided, and also the way it was approached and framed to member states.
Thank you for explaining that. I think it's really interesting just to understand kind of which bits are new and which aren't, especially as the book continues, you talk about kind of new things that are being done. So to understand sort of within the context is very helpful. I'd love to then get into kind of some of the practical things that were done. And you mentioned the charter, and that is a really key part of the UN. And the secretariat, which you focus on, was quite involved in kind of the charter and discussions around what does the charter mean, etc. And obviously one of the parts of the charter that got a lot of attention in this period was about kind of what are the implications for what it says in the charter, that how, what impact does this have on the idea of decolonization? Because there are kind of, as you describe in the book, some like maybe not conflicting things. I don't know if that would be too harsh, but kind of room for debate, I suppose. So can you tell us a bit about how the Secretariat specifically kind of as that piece of the UN was involved in these discussions about kind of what the charter means for decolonization?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that people at the time would have even used the term decolonization that we now use. But what was definitely open when it came to the charter was the role of the UN with regards to the colonial world. So on the one hand, it gave people who were arguing for immediate independence for colonies ammunition, so to say. And on the other hand, it also internationalized this idea that colonialism was a form of international trusteeship, for the benefit of the people inhabiting colonies. So if this is somewhat abstract, there are basically two parts in the charter that explicitly refer to colonies. On the one hand, you have this section on so-called non-self-governing territories as colonies were termed by the UN. This is chapter 11. And here, member states at San Francisco, where the UN Charter was finalized, agreed that the interests of the inhabitants of these territories was paramount, and that their well-being should be promoted by those who assumed the responsibilities of administration, as it was put. So colonial rule was basically reframed as administration, which is also interesting in itself. And the charter said that the colonial powers, the administrating authorities in UN lingo, were supposed to, on the one hand, protect inhabitants in those territories against abuses, but also promote their political, economic, social, and educational advancement. And the charter also said that promises would not suffice, but that these colonial powers would have to report on the measures and progress on these issues to the Secretary General. So that was one important section in the charter relating to the colonial world. And on the other hand, she also had a section on the UN trusteeship system, which established a more direct UN oversight over the administration or rule of select colonies, so-called UN trust territories, which had previously been supervised by the League of Nations under the mandate system. And at the UN, there was a main organ, the UN Trusteeship Council, tasked with supervising the supposed progress in those territories based on reports that administering authorities or colonial powers submitted to the UN, but also based on petitions that people from those territories sent to New York and based on the reports of visiting missions that the UN dispatched to those territories. And now, what was the role of the UN Secretariat in all this, which is what I was interested in? With regard to colonial rule more generally, which is what this first section focused on, the Declaration on Non-Self-Governing Territories. For one thing, the Secretariat worked with national delegations at the UN to set up a committee within the General Assembly that would discuss the information that colonial powers had to submit to the Secretary General on the supposed progress they achieved in their colonies. And it doesn't sound as much, but initially the colonial powers didn't even want to submit any information at all on matters going on in the colonies, because they said this was a sovereign issue, so to say. So this mechanism, as my colleague Jessica Pearson has also argued, open colonial rule up to international scrutiny. And to a degree, you already had that with the League of Nations mandate system, but there it was really restricted to a select number of colonies. Whereas now with the UN, colonies, dependencies more generally were opened up to this kind of international scrutiny. And part of what the Secretariat did was framing how progress in these colonies would be defined by basically formulating the questionnaires on the basis of which governments submitted their reports. So that was one thing. And in the case of the trust territories, this one short answer is that they would have liked to play more of a prominent role in kind of guiding the progress in these territories. But aside from the former Italian colonies, that wasn't generally the case. And here too, though, they framed how progress was defined with the formulation of these questionnaires, but also with those visiting missions reports. And of course, they also had a kind of gatekeeping function relating to the voices that would be heard on the matter, as they selected and categorized the petitions that were sent to the UN from trust territories.
Thank you for explaining that. I'm really glad you highlighted kind of the idea of it doesn't sound like a big deal, but, right? Because it is a massive deal, right? The changing the basic premise from, if this is your colony, it's no one's business but yours, to, oh, actually, you need to submit reports on these things, and you need to submit them regularly, and they're going to kind of essentially be cross-examined against what the other empires are submitting. Doesn't necessarily mean that practices on the ground suddenly get magically better. But, you know, as we talk about with any sort of problem solving, the first thing is to like know what is actually happening. And that's a really big step forward. So might you be able to give us sort of like one example of a particular thing that the Secretariat was interested in finding out from these reports, or a particular area that they focused on, maybe?
I think what's interesting about these questionnaires is perhaps not so much any particular new items that were put in on the agenda, but just how expansive and detailed they were, that the colonial powers had to report on anything really, from law to health services, to educational services, to social programs. And I think all in all, it were 100 to 150 questions that they had to report on. So it wasn't necessarily a particular area that was brought to the table by the Secretariat, but just the level of detail that colonial powers were required or prodded to report about. And I think in the literature on the UN and decolonization, or perhaps more so obviously in UN promotional material, there's often a tendency to perhaps exaggerate the role that the UN played with regard to decolonization. But I think one thing one can safely say based on these mechanisms is that you had this opening up of colonial rule to international scrutiny, and that this made colonial rule in the post-war period more cumbersome ultimately, and in that sense perhaps contributed to the outcome of these cost-benefit analyses also that many colonial powers undertook during that period with regard to colonial rule.
Very important to highlight. Thank you. I found that section of the book absolutely fascinating, because it's kind of one thing to know that, oh yeah, the UN collects lots of reports and data, and another to actually think through the implications of that. So I do want to move on to the section of the book where you talk about your case studies, which were really cool, as I said at the beginning of the interview. And I wonder if you can first help us understand, obviously case selection is really tricky when doing research. So how did you choose to focus on Libya, Somaliland, Bolivia, and the Congo for your case studies?
Right. And so I think it's also different from discipline to discipline, right? How
absolutely.
How case studies are being chosen and so on. And now that most of my colleagues are social scientists, rather than coming from the humanities, as with previous positions that I held, I definitely think about it in a different way. And I could give you a very polished answer now that rationally explains the selection in hindsight. But I think, and since you said that perhaps some PhD students are listening in on this, or MA students as well, that might be helpful also to admit that for a very long time I wasn't at all certain at what shape the book would take and what cases I would focus on. And a colleague actually recently sent me an early research proposal that I came up with when I started to work on the dissertation. And the project described in that proposal actually had very little to do with the actual shape of the book that came out. So
I'm sure to a lot of listeners. So thank you for sharing that.
To remember, I think when obsessing about where to go next, especially at the beginning of research projects, that it's also okay and actually something desirable not to have the exact shape of what you're going to write at the very beginning, right? Because otherwise, why bother with the investigation? Okay, but sorry for the long digression, but going in, I had a very basic question about, as I said, how did the UN navigate this tension of its imperial legacy on the one hand between trusteeship in the name of development and expertise and self-determination and respect for state sovereignty on the other hand, and what role did the organization play in decolonization? And case I focused on was the UN operations in the Congo in the early 60s. And that was sort of an obvious choice because it loomed large in all writing about the UN and decolonization as a sort of make or break moment about the role that the organization would play in processes of decolonization. And then the former Italian colonies, which I also looked at, Libya and Somaliland, were interesting too, because here the UN was really hands-on involved in the decolonization processes, which was kind of an accident of history, if you will, and a result of the inability of the victorious powers of World War II to agree on the fate of these colonies, which meant that the decision, what was supposed to be, happen with them, was passed on to the General Assembly, which decided to have a UN presence on the ground to guide the decolonization process. So, and the choice of Bolivia, I guess, was less straightforward, but I had read in some secondary literature and also memoirs of UN officials that during the 1950s, the UN essentially took over the government administration for a time, which is not quite true, but this is how it was portrayed, and that sounded like a very extreme example of the UN assuming trusteeship in the name of development. And since no one seemed to have really looked into this episode, I was really curious to explore it. And then once I delved into the records, there were also cross-references of people in Libya, say, talking about this experiment going on in Bolivia at the time, but also UN officials in the Congo referring back to Bolivia, for example, and building on that experience. So there were some connections between these cases. But it took me a while to decide on what to focus on specifically. But one thing that I did want to do was try to get away from debates that were, or not so much get away from debates that were going on in New York, but see how they were affected by this engagement of UN personnel in missions abroad or in negotiations abroad in member states, but also colonies at the time.
Thank you for explaining that. I mean, it does come across in the book as a very kind of useful collection of cases that highlight different aspects of what was happening. But it is also helpful to kind of understand, like, oh yeah, case selection is hard. Like, it's not something that has some sort of inevitable conclusion. And it is very much a process. So I think that's useful to hear. I would like to kind of ask little bits about the case studies. Sadly, again, we're not going to be able to cover all of it, but we can start off in Libya. And if you can tell us about, so the UN Secretary officials providing technical assistance in Libya, and you argue that this particular experience for Secretary officials really influenced how the UN thought about the practice of state building and what it meant to do state building. So kind of what happened in Libya that influence this kind of overall conceptual thinking for the UN?
Mm-hmm. Well, so what I think changed about the conception of state building, or well, let's start another way, I guess. I think or what I would argue is that it really only became a process and a practice involving all sorts of international technical experts in the post-war period, and this was partly related to the changing expectations that people had with regard to states during that period, that they were expected to engage in all different areas of public life that hadn't necessarily been the case before. But the problem in Libya, as UN officials perceived it, was basically how to build a modern independent state within 2 years, because the decision by the General Assembly had been reached in late 1949, and the official independent state was already given as well 2 years later. And at first, this is also what delegates at the General Assembly were concerned about, that within this period, the country would have to receive a constitution, a parliament, a government, or especially a government. But aside from these concerns, UN officials on the ground, there was a UN commissioner in Tripoli. And aside from these concerns about forming a government and coming up with a constitution for the country, the commissioner and his staff soon became more concerned, actually, not so much with this framework, but the economic and administrative basis on which the future state could operate. So first they organized survey missions to look into questions of banking and land tenure, education, health services, and so on. And then they also began to call on the UN and its member states more so to invest in assistance in these different fields to help the future state operate beyond independence. So state building also became something that was not necessarily completed upon independence, but something that would go on for many years beyond the formal independent state.
And what kind of from that experience did the UN then take to kind of other instances? Or to what extent was Libya like a complete outlier and they're like, never again, we will never attempt this?
Well, I think to a degree, Libya was a moment for the UN to dream about a more expansive role for the organization, because they were hoping to provide a sort of a head economist who would guide the country's development plan, and for UN personnel to work in very senior positions within the Libyan administration or alongside the Libyan administration, and to guide the country's progress step by step. And that didn't happen because particularly British officials, but also French officials, continued to work in some of the key positions within the Libyan administration. But those plans they came up with, and the hopes for UN officials guiding development through key positions within the administration, that was something that they came back to in different missions as well. Bolivia was something that was going on sort of at the same time, but then also in the Congo, this was something that that they drew on.
So let's go then to Bolivia, and Bolivia's mission. I admit I definitely didn't know very much about it, though my background's mainly in African history, so I suppose fair enough. But I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about kind of the UN's proposed plan for assisting Bolivia and kind of what the reactions were, especially given how much sort of change there was on the Bolivian government side in this time period.
So what I focused on for Bolivia was the so-called Kinley site proposal, Kinley site plan, named after a Canadian civil servant who went on a UN survey mission to Bolivia in the late 1940s, and he wrote a very long report, had a number of officials with him, a number of experts for different different aspects. But what it came down to was him basically saying that to the Bolivians, you've been unable to govern yourself successfully for the past 125 years. There was a frequent turnover of government, all in all 60 different presidents, and therefore no stability. And we can do it for you. We can ensure a measure of administrative or government stability, and we'll make the very best use of your amazing natural resources. So as you can imagine, that proposal didn't go down very well in that form. And one factor, I suppose, was also that the UN and the US were often conflated by Bolivians, but also others in Latin America at the time. So rejecting this offer by the UN, which was framed as assistance in public administration or administrative assistance, was also a rejection, if you will, of U.S. meddling. I think that was also part of the equation. Why was it accepted anyway by such different governments? I can only speculate, because I concentrated mainly on the UN side and UN sources. But for the authoritarian government in power, when the first UN experts arrived, this was probably also about losing support and staff amid what was basically a civil war, and the UN providing some welcome relief in that situation. And then you had the revolutionary left-wing Movimiento Nacional Revolucionario take over in 1952. And they were, on the other hand, they had denounced the UN plan as an infringement of sovereignty. But on the other hand, they were seriously committed to the goal of development and hopeful that the UN might support their efforts, and perhaps even that this UN support might lead to US support. And if that was the strategy, to a degree, it also paid off, because US officials were indeed willing to give this experiment in development by the MNR, as it was then called, a chance, despite its nationalization platform and so on. And Washington dealing very differently with other left-wing governments in the hemisphere at the time.
Very complicated, but really interesting as well. Like, even just that of kind of how do you take a plan and negotiate it with lots of different governments going on, regardless of what the plan is, and then adding in the details of the plan and the US element, etc. Definitely kind of, I think, demonstrates the complexity of this time period, and how, like, none of this was set in stone. And maybe today we think of some UN policies as being kind of, oh yeah, this is what always happens. And I think this book, and in some senses, this case in particular, is a really helpful way of being like, oh yeah, at some point this all had to be figured out. and that has implications. So the obvious case, your last one, that has implications for today is the Congo. You've mentioned that a little bit already. And I was wondering if you could kind of, similarly to with Bolivia, help us understand how was the kind of operation that eventually ends up happening on the ground with the UN in the Congo. How is that mission, how is it possible that that mission could be so different from what the Congo actually originally requested?
Mm-hmm. I mean, again, it's similar with Bolivia, that I primarily focused on the UN side of the story. But what I gathered from the sources was the Congolese officials, even before independence, were primarily interested in UN military assistance, so that they wouldn't be reliant on Belgian military personnel. And once the post-independence conflict broke out, to stop Katanga's and then later Kasai's secession. But what the UN sought to provide instead, or rather perhaps in addition to the military support and troops, was essentially a parallel government structure that could operate independently of the Congolese one and take care of public services that broke down with the retreat of the Belgians. And again, UN officials had dreamed of such a program in the former Italian colonies and perhaps with regard to Bolivia as well. But in the Congo, they really came close to realizing that technocratic rule with disastrous consequences, obviously, for the Congo and the UN as well. And it very much demonstrated the limits of UN capabilities to undertake such efforts, and no similar efforts really were undertaken until the end of the Cold War, when, however, this kind of developmental peacekeeping, because it was both, right? On the one hand, you had the military side of the operation, and on the other hand, this very large, civil services and civil operations. Providing teachers and doctors and so on. And this kind of combination was really new at the time and pioneered in the 60s. Not really tried again, I think, until the end of the Cold War, but then taken to new heights.
Very much so. And why was it that the UN Secretariat officials were kind of so set on the idea of a technocratic solution being the best thing for sort of state building, sovereignty, becoming independent, etc.?
It's a tough question. Why were they so set on finding a technocratic solution to this?
Yeah, because there was such an emphasis across the cases of kind of like, as long as we can sort public administration, like that will be the thing that will make all of this work. Where did that belief come from?
I guess it wasn't just that. There were also, of course, political negotiations going on at the same time that they were invested in. But the hope was that one thing you had to invest in parallel to that was basically just keeping public services going to avoid a complete breakdown of the country and humanitarian disaster and so on. And I mean, I think that's thinking isn't so hard to understand. That there, I think it would make sense to today's listeners as well. But then the jump from assuming that people who had no idea about the Congo whatsoever, being transplanted all of a sudden from New York to take over very important positions in the country sort of overnight is more of leap of thought that's very hard to understand in hindsight or from our perspective today.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think one of the things that can be particularly helpful for understanding history that has implications for what we're dealing with today is understanding the things that didn't happen. and obviously we've talked about your case studies where the UN does go and do things, but you also talk about in the book a proposal that doesn't really seem to have ever gotten off the ground for something called the International Administrative Service. So kind of why was this being pushed by the Secretariat and what was the argument around what it had to do with decolonization?
Mm-hmm. So this was a proposal made in 1956 to dispatch international administrators to newly independent states to help them manage their state bureaucracies until they could do so themselves. The thinking behind it being that not enough there were not enough trained nationals, basically, because in some cases decolonization happened much faster than people on different sides would have expected in the 1950s. And the idea was that if you had international personnel coming in, these newly independent states wouldn't necessarily have to rely on former colonial officials in the meantime, which many of them did, and thus ensure a degree of independence, if you will, or non-dependence at least, and also allow the UN at the same time to steer development in what they perceived as the right direction, i.e. Social democratic capitalist path of development. And as you already said, this was more of a hope than a reality. The program was established under the name of OPEX, for operational, a UN program for operational and executive personnel, but it didn't become this huge service that Hammarskjöld and others had wanted it to be. So it remained comparatively small and insignificant. But I would argue that it was important nevertheless, because in negotiating this proposal, this took several years and it went through a lot of different UN committees and fora. And in negotiating this proposal, governments essentially reframed what was acceptable in terms of technical assistance, i.e. that it wasn't just advisory services, but that outside personnel could actually take over key functions that would have otherwise been considered too sensitive for outside interference. So in a sense, it also changed how governments thought about how states could operate, namely by drawing on outside assistance in the realms of governance also.
Mm. As I said, I think it's really helpful to understand things that didn't necessarily become as big a thing as they were proposed to be. And it's for exactly those reasons. Like, just because something doesn't end up the way, the kind of process it goes through still can kind of tell us a lot. So thank you for explaining that. As we come towards kind of the end of the book and some of the arguments, I mean, you've already been mentioning, obviously, the arguments you're making. But one of the arguments I wanted to ask about was about how this process, these processes of technical assistance from the UN being part of paths to independence or consolidating independence for countries that were formerly colonized. How is this related to kind of the debate around sort of should things be nation states? Should nation states be how we organize things, especially as we're talking about decolonial processes? So can you kind of tell us about the role of UN technical assistance in these wider debates about what should come out of decolonization?
Right. Yeah, that's a big one. And I know, I mean, I set myself up for it, but that was one thought going into the project also, that there was a lot of interesting research at the time on decolonization, showing that in the 50s, 60s, and in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it wasn't at all clear, right, that decolonization would result in this world of nominally independent nation states that we now take for granted, and that there were other ideas about possible outcomes, ranging from regional federation. Some of them were tried, and also ideas about a closer association between former colonial powers and former colonies, ideally on equal footing, and so on. So, in what sense did the UN contribute to this outcome that we now see, that we now take for granted? And one factor, I think, were the debates going on within the General Assembly and so on at the time, how political progress was framed there by member states and decided, for example, with regards to Libya and Somaliland. And another factor was also the institutional logic of the organization, where member states who have a say represent nominal nation states. And then finally, international technical assistance initiatives covered in the book too, I think, were a factor in that they made nominal independence possible and practicable for states with very little resources, such as the ones that I discuss in more detail in the book. But I mean, it's still a very interesting question, I think, and certainly not the last words what I attempted to contribute to that debate.
contributions to debates are still useful and important for us. I don't think any of us ever have the final word on anything. So thank you for explaining that. Again, I don't think it's necessarily an aspect that we might think of when we think about kind of what happens with decolonization, what's the role of the UN, kind of some of these like practical elements of technical assistance maybe don't seem connected, but I think a really important contribution to the book is showing that it's not just connected, it's like a really key part of it, and the people involved in these debates. So I think that that's a really useful contribution. None of us are ever going to have answers to anything. Yeah. So, you know.
Thank you very much.
So now that the book is done, what are you working on next?
So right now, I'm very interested in the so-called lost decade of development of the 1980s and the role that international financial institutions actually played during that period. So again, I'm interested in the internal dynamics within these institutions, how and what did they learn from their engagement abroad over time. And another thing that I'm particularly fascinated in with regards to that period is also the widespread protests to or against structural adjustment programs that you saw at the time. So in Berlin in 1988, for example, there were 10,000s of people taking to the streets to protest against these programs, which I think somehow gets lost in our understanding of the 1980s and the neoliberal turn, if you will, being either imposed or there not being really an alternative at the time. So one thing that I'm interested in is learning more about the contestations of this term at the time, both at within international organizations, but also very publicly on the streets at different places.
Ooh, that sounds fascinating. Ooh, that sounds quite fun. Cool. All right. Well, you are off diving into what sounds like a very fascinating project. Listeners can read the book that we've been discussing, which again is titled Building States, the United Nations Development and Decolonization, 1945 to 1965, from Columbia University Press in 2022. Dr. Eva Maria Mushik, thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much, Miranda. Thank you for having me.